I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Tonight's program is about the fast-growing Maryland artisanal cheesemaking industry. We are pleased to welcome three local cheesemakers, each working with a different animal, goat, cow, and sheep, as well as a cheesemonger from our local Whole Foods market, who will talk about the growth and trends in the local cheese industry. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
This is our fifth installment and our most popular. I think cheese did it, huh? Hope nobody's on a diet tonight. We're highlighting local producers, farmers, fishermen, watermen, beekeepers, food historians, and the whole goal is to sort of create a wider conversation about our local Chesapeake and Mid-Atlantic food sources. And we all know that what Spike is doing here with his team takes that to an incredible level. And we just thought it'd be fun to listen to the people behind the scenes, the food that you're eating, and how it all sort of comes together magically at your plate at Woodbury Kitchen or Parts and Labor. The two upcoming events that we have are going to also be fantastic. Our next one is Thursday, October 22nd. It is on, focus will be on bees, honey, and pollinators. We have an amazing panel, which I have one more speaker to confirm, but it's really going to be interesting, and we'll learn about why you should keep certain weeds in your garden and not pull them out. So it's a very important discussion, and we all need to learn a little bit about what's going on in our backyards and how to improve our backyards. The November one will be November 19th, and that I think will be one of Spike's favorite, I shouldn't say.
Right there after cheese.
It'll be on indigenous Maryland Chesapeake area foods. And we're hoping to have a forager. We have a historian. We'll talk a little bit about heirloom foods and get into that whole discussion, which is much, much, much needed to learn about this area. So that's it. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Spike, who will introduce our wonderful cheese panel tonight. And thank you all for coming.
And we have to thank Dana. It's hard to comprehend what it takes to make something like this happen and what it takes really to keep it happening. It's one thing to pull this off once, but the fact that this is our fifth Origins, I think, is a testament to Dana's tenacity and energy. And so we thank her for that. She got it off the ground and she's kept it flying high all these months, and we're looking forward to a great season. So welcome to Origins. This is indeed our fifth go around here. And I have to say, I think along with this record capacity crowd, I am more excited about this Origins than anyone that we've done up till now. And I love oysters and I love meat, but this one is going to be great. So thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to start off with a little reading, actually. I haven't done this before. We have a great novelist here in the city, Laura Lipman, and one of the things I love about her work is that she uses local restaurants and other locations for the action in her books. And this caught my eye a few years ago. It was actually in 2009. The book is called Life Sentences, a novel. And there is a restaurant that you may or may not recognize that was a setting for part of the action. What do you think, her father demanded the next morning. Very striking. Not the decor, the food. It's part of the locavore movement, devoted to area foods. All I've had is a cup of coffee, and that's not local, surely. It's March, her father said, defensive of his discovery. And they're not 100% local, or all we'd be eating would be, I don't know, some kind of roots with eggs, I guess. But philosophically, they're trying to use as much local food as possible. Then it moves ahead, and she goes back. Then again, her father's choice of restaurant, while interesting in theory, had been challenging in practice. He hadn't been far off about the root vegetables and eggs, and the so-called local cheese had been appalling. And so, it's kind of interesting to have our work there memorialized in the literature for all time. But I think, you know, it was, I hate to say it, but it probably was a somewhat accurate assessment of where cheese was, and this was all of 6 or 7 years ago. I'm happy to say that this distinguished panel here, I don't think we're yet included on our cheese course, so none of you, I think, really have anything to be ashamed of in that regard. And I think we've come so far since that time not so long ago. And I think cheese, and one of the reasons I think I'm so interested in it, is because it kind of belies the whole idea of farm-to-table. I think farm-to-table has become very simplistic in kind of our thinking. And obviously, with cheese, it can't just be farm-to-table, because you have to have somebody in between, in this case, amazing cheesemakers, for it to work. And I would say that our cheese has come a long way from when we started Woodbury Kitchen in 2007. And one of the reasons is this incredible group. And I'm going to introduce them now, starting with Colleen and Michael Histon of Shepherd's Manor Creamery. All of these are Maryland-based. Is that true? Shucks! We'll edit that out, right? All right. Mid-Atlantic. I should have. All right. Mid-Atlantic. Or
Chesapeake Watershed.
Yes, thank you. Very true. Chesapeake Watershed. But you guys are in Maryland.
Yes.
All
right.
We are.
Great. We also have Holly Foster, owner and cheesemaker at Chapel's Country Creamery, somebody we have been working with a very long time, always thrilled to have her cheese at Woodbury and the other places. And then certainly right here to my right, Pam Miller of Charlottetown Farm, making amazing goat's cheese in nearby Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
All right. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves. But rounding out our panel is Anadine Kanzian. Yes. Close.
Yeah.
Anadina.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to try that again. Rounding out our panel is Anadina Kanzian, our Whole Foods team cheese team leader. Is that true? Is that close?
That is.
How would you describe it?
I'm the Whole Foods Market Specialty Team Leader at Mount Washington.
Great. And she is going to give us kind of that overall view of what's going on with cheese in this region. First, I'd love to hear from Colleen and Michael about what they do at Shepherd's Manor.
Hi, I'm Colleen, and I am the cheesemaker. I was one of the shepherds, but this year, luckily, I am now not milking, so Michael is handling that. So I do all of the cheesemaking and also a lot of the marketing. I go to several farmers markets a week and package, label all of the cheese, and usually deliver most of it to local places that we sell to.
And that, like my wife said, I'm basically the shepherd fill-in marketing person and the general fix-it person. And if anyone knows anything about farms, nothing ever goes right, number one. And number two, when you're in the milk production or cheese production of any type, something always seems to always go wrong, and it's never an item where you can sit. It's like if Spike's gentleman had a problem in the back kitchen, you can't say, oh, I'll fix it in 20 minutes. Everything is very time constrained, so it's pretty impressive.
And you guys are, what is it that you're milking, just so we can...
Okay, we are milking sheep. We're the first and only sheep dairy in the state of Maryland. Sheep are the oldest milked animal in the world, 4,000 years. It was the first cheese ever made. The two types of sheep that we are milking are Laconne and East Frisian. The Laconne are from France and the East Frisian are from Austria. And they have two distinctive looks to them. The Laconne are taller, got a clean neck to them, and the East Frisian are shorter, squattier, and had generally have a bigger udder to them.
Great, thanks. Holly?
Hi, my name is Holly Foster. Our farm is in Easton, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. My husband came from a long line of farmers and have always dabbled in dairy, so he got his bachelor's degree in animal science and wanted to be a vet, and then after that, he's like, "Now I'm done with school, I'm tired, I just want to milk cows." So I came along as a learning. I grew up in town learning to be the farmer's wife, so I tried to get that under my belt with learning how to milk cows. So like you guys said, farming and all, there's so much to learn just with that. So I feel like we're always late, and then my husband couldn't attend tonight because somebody had to milk the cows. So we're celebrating our 10-year anniversary this year. We got started before it was legal to make raw milk cheese in the state of Maryland. We just shipped our milk to Pennsylvania, and I would actually make our cheese with a cheesemaker in Pennsylvania and learned a lot from being able to do that. It was actually a blessing to do that. So then when we built our creamery on the farm, I knew some equipment and some things that I wanted and didn't want. And also Maryland moved along, and they were able to set out a pilot program, 5-year pilot program, where we were able to make our cheese on our farm, raw milk, instead of sending it to Pennsylvania to do. So we've been doing that 6 years now because it's done. The five-year pilot program is done, so it's now law. Anybody that, you know, wants to do farmstead raw milk cheese is now open for that. So that's a good thing that's gone in the right direction for that. We have Jersey cows. We have 112 acres, and we do rotational grazing, and we're milking 36 right now. And most of that, it's all gone into cheese and yogurt, but mainly it's cheese. So it's been a lot of fun in those 10 years developing different cheeses and working with great people like Spike and the local movement and people that really appreciate it. And as Spike knows and a lot of our customers know, they know what goes into the farming and into the background of it before it comes in the box, you know, to the restaurant or to where it's going. So we really appreciate all of our customers that support that and go into that. So thanks for having us.
Great. Thank you for being here. Pam?
So I'm Pam Miller, owner and cheesemaker of Charlottetown Farm. The dairy is in Pennsylvania. And I go up there and make the cheese, and so our partners, they do the milk and I make the cheese, so it's a really good relationship. Currently they're milking 123, and I also make goat milk confections, and that's at a facility, an incubator kitchen in York in Pennsylvania. And so I make a goat cheese cheesecake, goat milk fudge, and goat milk caramel sauce. So I've only been doing this for about 4 years, and I originally started, some people know this story, my daughter, an only child, was getting ready to go to college, and the people that I'm close to told me that I needed to get involved in something or else I would drive them crazy. So I started out just kind of making cheese, small batch, just for my friends, garden club people, things like that, and everybody kept telling me I should kind of take it more seriously, and so I kind of got into the business, and I love what I do, and we love working with restaurants. We've brought baby goats down for different occasions, and we're at the Waverly Farmers Market on Saturdays and the Bel Air Farmers Market on Saturdays as well, and really just love what I do and love making cheese and all the fun stuff, and we appreciate all the all our relationship with Woodbury.
Stop. And Adina, you know, I gave us kind of a dim sense of where we started from, you know, these few years ago. And you're somebody that sees and tastes a lot of cheese. And I would love to just get your perspective on what you see, in our Maryland and our watershed cheese, the state of that, and how it really stacks up to, you know, to the cheeses of the world.
So I started working in cheese at Whole Foods Market in 2005, and I think that I have a pretty unique experience because that was kind of the beginning of the American cheese renaissance. Whenever I first started at the Inner Harbor Whole Foods, I had about 4 or 5 American cheeses. And now my case contains about 8 feet of American artisanal cheeses. And among those are some of our Maryland producers that we have here. In 2005, customers were really a little bit hesitant to taste American cheeses because if it wasn't French, it wasn't good. Or if it wasn't a European cheese, then maybe it wasn't the one that they wanted to serve to their guests. But now people are definitely starting to realize that American cheese producers can really keep up and sometimes do a better job than some of these European producers, and they're closer to home, and that's what customers are looking for. Grass-fed and raw milk cheeses, organic cheeses, these are all things that people want now, and it's really great to, I got to see it from the beginning to the end. And I also had a wonderful opportunity to be in the first class of the American Cheese Society Certified Cheese Professionals in 2012. And since then, even the interest in American artisanal cheeses has really blossomed even more. The past couple of years, people watch the judging competition. They look for the winners. They come in and they ask for it.
It's really, really incredible. And thank you for having me.
Not at all.
To share my experience.
So glad you're here.
Yeah.
So we're going to look for questions from you guys whenever you're ready. That is what's made, I think, Origins so special is the questions we get from the audience. I want to start, though, because this landscape is, like, literally changing so quickly. And I think, Holly, you are really responsible for some of that change. And I remember talking to you back in the day when you were still making cheese up in Pennsylvania and trying to work through with the state and getting farmstead cheeses even allowed, right? And, you know, a little bit about what that was like. And then I would love to hear from Colleen and Pam about maybe some of the challenges, obviously first starting with kind of regulatory and governmental, but then maybe talking about other challenges, because I know, in addition, as Michael said, to keeping everything running, there are other challenges, you know, when you're working like this.
I think with the state, it came to the politicians. I did it all really started with a political fundraiser, and the politicians in our area were just so excited that, you know, that farming is moving more into, you know, can be artisan. You can set your another generation coming behind you, and it's not just all doing beans and corn. You know, you can do something different and more, you know, hands-on, artsy, and direct to your market. You can cut out a middleman. So the politicians were so excited about, you know, this being in Talbot County and on the Eastern Shore and cheese. And I was like, the cows are, but I'm making this myself in Pennsylvania because I'm not allowed to make it in Maryland. Well, their eyes were like, what? So I think that they saw that with us and the cheese developing, the business growing, you know, that they saw an opportunity that they could have something grow there in Maryland. So they asked, you know, for us to be their pilot program to help them lead that up. And I'm panicking, thinking I'm just learning how to make cheese, and you mean to what? So it was really the politicians and the state themselves, the health department and all. We really just became a team. We had to become a team because we work together constantly, as you guys know too, because the laws are constantly changing, and we have to keep up with that. And it was a learning experience for the state. So it was a learning experience for everybody, and everybody gives everybody a little grace and room to breathe. But, you know, sometimes, you know, there's the books and the law books and then what's going on, and, like, you know, to keep up with it, and it can be difficult, but we just look at them, at the state and the politicians, they're all part of the team, because it takes all of us to do it, and you just had to bring them on and work with them and be open with what, you know, you want to do, what you can do, what other states are doing, and keep it like that. So we get to share a lot of stories together on, you know, oh, guess what they just changed. Guess what that's going to affect, you know. So with that said, I'm so excited that Maryland has a new Maryland Cheese Guild out now, and it is going to be awesome, amazing. And they just had, we were at the Maryland Wine Festival, and they just did their first competition for I guess they would consider us professional cheesemakers, right. Not just, yes. You know, the kitchen cheesemakers or whatever. So, you know, making the public aware, especially at the Maryland Wine Festival, all these great Maryland cheeses are out there now. I think that was a big door opened, and it was great. And it was fun because, you know, as I look at the other cheesemakers, you know, I don't look at them, they're not competition. We're a networking system, and we help each other out. And you know what's working for us, you know, we make it work for each other, and it was great. It was very, very interesting, very fun, very educational for everybody.
Awesome.
Okay. 2008 we decided to do this, and Michael went and sat down with a milk control person to find out what we needed to look into, and they had no idea what to do with us, because sheep's milk cheeses are very unknown. There's only 1% of sheep's milk cheese being made in the United States. The other 99% is being imported. So there are very few farms out there for them to look at. So I wanted to be in the raw milk program right off the get-go. I just knew that I wanted to make raw milk cheese, that it would have more flavor, there were more attributes to it. So we wanted to do whatever we needed to do. It really wasn't, hadn't even started yet. I don't think it started until 2009. And I was so afraid that we were not going to get into it on time because they told us there's only going to be 5 dairies in Maryland that are going to be allowed to be in this program. So you have to sign up, you know, right away. So I did before we even moved. We weren't even on the farm yet. So before we had the farm, before we had the dairy, I signed up for the program. And then when it got started, I kept saying, I would call them up and say, you know, am I still going to be able to do this? Yes, yeah, you're still on the list. Well, it turned out only 3 of us ended up doing it. One cow dairy, Holly, one goat dairy, and then us, a sheep dairy. When we started to build the building, as we went along doing the different parts of building, they started traveling to New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania to go visit sheep dairies so they could find out how to regulate us. They had no idea. So, you know, they got their ducks in order, and then they would come back and tell us, you know, things that they wanted us to do, how they wanted us to go about. And we did whatever they said, pretty much. I mean, Michael had his arguments about a few things, you know, he wasn't real happy with. And he would usually have concrete information to supply to them as to why he felt the way he did about certain things. And we had a lot of funny stories, you know, that would take all night as to how those things went along, but not to be said at this moment. So anyways, we did what we needed to do, and it came about, and it worked out, you know. And yes, now there is a Maryland Cheese Guild, which is awesome. You know, they wanted us to have a cheese festival, and maybe at some point in time down the road, Maryland will have its own separate Maryland Cheese Festival. Cool. And we'll bring in, you know, other dairies that are in the Chesapeake region, watershed. Hopefully, watershed. Yeah, and do that. So that's what we're hoping. That's the future, you know, to make awareness of cheeses. Now the pilot program is a full-fledged program at this point in time. And I believe there's still only 3 or 4 of us maybe that are making raw milk cheese. But it's going along just fine. They finally believe in us, I believe, that in right. what we're doing, that we are credible.
Right. So, any hurdles, Pam, that you want to share?
Just when I was first starting with this, I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to go about it, because I knew that if I tried to, you know, build a dairy in Maryland, it would be years and years, and, you know, I had heard horror stories, and mm-hmm. so we sought out someone in Pennsylvania that had the licensure already. Mm-hmm. So we went into partners with them, and like I said, they, you know, the goats are their responsibility. They milk them, and then they have the milk for us to make the cheese. So it works out really well. It's a little intense with having to travel so much. That's the downside. But the, you know, I go up to the dairy probably about 3 times a week, and then to the incubator kitchen another few times. So, but we make the cheese at the dairy, and the goat cheese cheesecake, goat milk fudge, and the caramel sauce at the incubator kitchen. So it's really been an amazing experience, and I respect these guys a lot for what they do with actually milking the animals and making the cheese, because I don't know how you guys do it.
Well, Anadina, what I kind of love and hate about the Whole Foods cheese case is that there's so much stuff there, including like Maryland cheeses, like that I haven't tried yet, and I tend to think that I know it all, which I clearly don't, because things are changing, as we're hearing. I think I had your washed rind cheddar. I think I got that at Whole Foods for the first time. I saw it, and I was like, well, I don't know what this is. I've never, and it's awesome. And I think we have that. Did we have that tonight on the board? And that's going to be a little part of our supper as well. But so that's kind of what I zero in on when I'm in Whole Foods, is like I look for the local cheeses and sometimes find stuff that I've never seen, sometimes from producers I don't know about, but awesome new things. What is it like selling Maryland cheese to the public?
It's so much fun.
I think one of the most wonderful jobs that I possibly could have happened into. We get to taste cheese all day. I get to share new cheese experiences with like the Marylanders, who are just starting to learn that there's a world beyond cheddar or sharp. So It's really great, and I also think it's kind of a privilege because as a cheesemonger, I think I'm kind of the middleman between these very wonderful, hardworking people who don't have the chance to be in front of the public and to show their face and sell their cheese. So I feel like I have the responsibility to do that for them. And I really love being able to represent the producers that I respect and sell product that I love.
Love to take now to get some questions.
So one of you mentioned developing new cheeses. I think it might have been Molly. So what goes into developing a new cheese? What are some of the factors you think about? How many of the new cheeses fail? What's that like?
Being in it for 10 years, we started out with four basic cheeses. And we were happy with that because they were just a little different. And some of those cheeses went really well at the farmers markets. Some of them went really well with the distributors or with Whole Foods and larger stores. So we get a little diversification in that. In transitioning right now, which we're in the middle of doing, transition sometimes is very painful and sometimes very time consuming. That is the same with developing new cheeses. So as we are adding on to our creamery and building more aging rooms, as the business is growing, we're shifting some of the cheeses that we're doing. And as these wonderful people here understand so clearly about the state, it can take one phone call and they will shut you down over a glitch on a piece of paper that they don't understand how to figure it out. So they've done that to me twice. Once was after making the blue for 4 years under their very close supervision of the pilot program. They said, but this piece of paper says that it has so much moisture content in it, and we're not going to have that in the state of Maryland, the raw milk, so you can't make blue cheese anymore. And I'm like, well, that was my, after developing this, it took, several years to really get the blue where I wanted it. And then we even tweaked it a little bit more, I think, to make it even better over the last, 6 months or a year. So we're constantly developing and evolving. So I have to say the biggest challenge with developing a new cheese is getting what you want out of your equipment and your facility and your milk and all, and then keeping it and doing a consistency. And then once you get the consistency of it, then when the doors open and say, hey, there's a new cheese out there, we're ready. How about if you taste it? You have no idea how many people are going to come on and take that or whether it's really going to go or not. It might be really good to you, but is it good to everyone else? So we do a couple things. We ask people like Spike and Whole Foods and our distributor and all, what are people asking for? So we start with that. So then we're like, okay, this is cool. Then we kind of narrow down, well, what do we like? Because if you don't like the cheese you're making, you're in trouble because you're going to be eating and tasting a lot of it. So those are kind of the two things. We want to know what the consumer wants and then going through the regulations. So with each new cheese, it's like starting a little bit from scratch with the state because you have to have your label approved. You have to have your SOPs. They have to come and make it, taste it. You have to run samples to the lab. It has to be in a certain moisture. It has to fall under certain criteria. So after you get, and then you have the artwork in it. You have all the, structure, but then the artwork has to go with it. So it's a combination of it all, but it is very tedious. We have two new cheeses out right now because we're making that shift of expanding and taking a few off that we knew years ago we would take off. And we're not having very much trouble with people complaining about taking what we're taking off because, Spike, I'm sure you're going to rotate your menu. You want new things, different things. So our cheese just won Best of Show at the Maryland Cheese Guild, the competition, but unfortunately it won't be ready for consumers till the spring. That's a bad thing. But I just wanted some judging, critiquing on it because it's a brand new cheese we're making. I mean,
which one was
best
that?
Critics.
Which cheese?
Woodland. It's a tome. It's replacing Chappelle. So, we're easing away from and expanding. And so it is a tome, but it's a different one. And so now we're excited about that. But now it's like, oh, gosh, that opened up a whole can of worms for a new cheese. And also with the Rainey's Dream to celebrate our 10-year anniversary, we put out a Camembert, which is a pasteurized cheese. Well, we decided to do that after the state gave us another scare about, you know, they'll come up with some ideas of, you know, not even sure if we're going to be able to continue with the raw milk cheese things. And I said, okay, that's it. We're putting it in a new cheese vat, a bigger cheese vat, and it's going to be able to adapt to a pasteurizer if need be. So bring on the state. I'm ready. Raw milk or pasteurized. I've got it. So we're just like, we're going to do a little of both. And I never thought I would do that, but I'm really enjoying doing that because then that cheese also has a better cash flow to it. This is what we were talking earlier. Some of these cheeses and the raw milk cheeses, they have to age 60 days or longer. So then we want to get on some hardier cheeses. And then with being in the state of Maryland, it has to fall under a certain moisture content. So those are your aged cheeses. Well, sometimes cash flow on those cheeses can be daunting after you have done the whole process. So it's gone both ways. Wow. It can go crazy.
Wow.
My name is Ted Rouse from founding partner of Big City Farms. We grow in urban greenhouses in the city. We grow organically, but we're not certified organic because of the cost of procuring OMRI certified materials. And so I'm just curious whether, I doubt that any of you are organic, although I don't know. And yet, being a farmer, or not, I'm not really a farmer, I'm really the instigator. Knowing how difficult it is to make farming an economic business, I'm just curious whether becoming organic or whether your practices, to what extent you have to use chemicals that prevent you, either herbicides or pesticides, that prevent you from being organic, and what your thoughts are about the whole issue.
This is Michael from Shepherd's Manor Creamery. We are not organic, and what kicks us out of the organic program are two things. One, I have to have a pressure-treated fence post because we back right up to the woods, and the termites just have a mayday with our other fence lines. So fencing is really critical because we do have a predator problem because we live along our railroad line, and they're infamous for coyotes and fox. The other thing that kicks us out of the organic program is we have a gazillion miles of fencing, and I can't afford the labor of someone to weed whack 7 days a week. So we spray with Roundup, very little bit. We've also tried the organic version of it, which is nothing but over-glorified vinegar. For some reason, our weeds thrived on that. Don't know why. It just didn't work out. We had two problems. One, the weeds bounced back really quick, which made no sense. And the second thing was it was really hard on all of the rubber on all of our spray equipment. So we decided to go back to Roundup the following year. So those are the only two things that kick us out of the program. We do not use GMO corn, which is very hard to find, or GMO soybeans, which is really hard to find. And it's sort of weird because when you look at the kernels of corn and you look at the soybeans, they're imperfected. I mean, they're not uniform. They got dings and dongs in them. It's sort of like apples now that the stink bugs are here. You know, and as Spike knows, you know, if someone sees an apple with a little ding in it, everybody now knows it's a stink bug ding, you know. So those are the things that push us out of there. We had thought about that, but there's also an upfront cost to get certified to be organic and figure out which organization you want to come under which umbrella. So when those questions come up, the other question that we get all the time, which I know it's a little veering off, is we do pasture rotation, which really doesn't work very well because our sheep are lazy. They don't leave the barn. We have hay that's in the barn, and we do that for rainy days. And we have a couple older girls that don't like to walk a lot, which I understand. And I'm in that same boat. So they'll go out when they want to, and everyone says, well, why don't you throw them out on the pasture? I says, well, I really don't want to push them out of the barn. The gate's open. They get to come and go when they want. And sometimes the farmer's markets, I've gotten a little battle, and I've had too many cups of coffee. And I said, what do you want me, taser them and push them out of the barn? You know? So I just sort of chuckled, and I have to realize or reel myself back in and look at it from their perspective, because they really want to care about the animals. We have one girl that works for us that's a vegetarian, which I'm really proud to say about, because that knows that we take care of the animals. And the bottom line is the take care of the soil, take care of the animals, and they'll eventually take care of you. We've won a couple soil through NCRS, which is soil conservation awards with that. So we do take care of our manure issues, and we have two creeks on the property. They're well shedded, and they're blocked off by fencing. So I hope that answered your question. What you asked seemed like a real quick, easy question, but that's a real big umbrella that can go in a bunch of different spectrums. So, sorry.
I'd like to say something about dealing with customers who are coming in and looking for buzzwords such as organic. And I think that's one of the areas where my job becomes very important in representing these producers, because people want the word organic, but they may not realize exactly what that means, or that this small farm practically is organic, but maybe it's too expensive, or maybe they have these challenges. So I think that as the Maryland cheese producers, as it continues to grow, if we keep having conversations about what these words actually mean, that we can continue to support small producers in that way.
Great, absolutely.
Telling the story of the farmers may be more important than the label organic.
Exactly. And I think that I get this question every single day, and I think that people are starting to realize what it is that they're looking for and asking for, and what it means to a small farm.
Mm-hmm. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the artistry of what you do, how you pick the sheep that you use. Did the Jersey cow just happen to be the cow that was there and
best cow
you used their milk because they were there, or did you pick them intentionally? And how do you create the flavors of the cheeses that you produce?
It's secret.
I'm going to divide the question into two groups, and then Holly's sort of cool because she gets to enter both of them. But for the animal perspective, the first thing you want is a good, healthy animal that isn't psychotic. So, because when you're milking an animal, when my animal kicks us, it's painful. When Holly's Jersey kicks, you go to the hospital. So animal disposition. We have one we call Dottie. She refuses to leave the milking parlor until she's scratched. So she'll clog up the whole lane. Someone has to go to the end of the lane, scratch her head, and say, "Now get out now." So those are the sort of semi-cool things, except when you're a real big hurry. And as for the only thing I'm going to comment about the milk and the cheeses is I look at it as a clean white palate that's extremely rich in nutrients, and then I'll let the cheesemakers comment on that. So sorry.
You should have finished that comment.
No, you get to go.
His comment with that is it's a clean, fresh palate with full of nutrients, and you then if you're making a raw milk cheese, you have all that wonderful
flavors,
nutrient value, and clean flavors, freshness in it. So when people ask, about the difference between pasteurizing, some people don't even understand what pasteurization means. So
explain it.
Pasteurization is bringing the temperature of the milk up to a level that kills everything in it. So then when you turn around and then, go add your bacteria, your cultures back in to make the palate what you want it to be, as opposed to working with the natural palate that it has in it already as a raw milk product, which is why, so many people believe raw milk is so much better for you. Okay, so having said that, making different flavors. I have a basic recipe, for lack of anything better to say. The artisanal part comes when you put it in your aging room and you work with it. You brush it, you wash it, you pat it, you turn it, and you develop it over time. So I use certain levels of my cultures in each one of those cheeses, different cultures that I purchase, and to make different styles of cheese that make different flavors in the cheese. There are so many different variables that come from making that cheese. I can take the same exact milk, the same exact temperature, the same exact starter culture, and I can put it in my room different days of the week. And my animals, what they ate out in the field, are going to change that, tweak it somewhat, depending on the grasses, depending on the time of year. Beginning of the year, their milk is not as rich. It's more plentiful. Toward the end of the season, which we're coming in, we're into right now, these last few weeks, I'm getting a higher yield on my milk because the milk is richer. It's going to produce more curds, you know, when I rennet it. So there's so many different variables with it. You know, you're starting with a basic palate, and you basically get within reason. It's kind of like wine. You know, you taste wine, and all wines are different levels of flavors. You know, have a very distinguished palate with that. You can taste all those differences. You know, the same with cheese.
I agree with that. I think one of the hardest things, learning the art you had mentioned, there's thousands of cultures out there. So then you like narrow it down to like, okay, so you have your certain customers, which would be Maryland's first raw milk cheese? Is it going to be a, and everybody else said blue, so that's what I made. But then I'm thinking, well, how many different blues are there out there? So then it just took a long time tweaking cultures, and you use culture cocktails, what I like to call it. You know, some cheeses have two cultures in it, and some have five, six, seven, you know. So each culture does its own little job in the aging process, like she was saying, and we can tweak it and change it. So you start with the same base, but each recipe can be different, the grasses. So we chose cows because my husband loves cows, but we chose Jersey cows for two different reasons. We knew we wanted to do intense rotational grazing, so they're lighter color. They are more heat hardy, so in, you know, July and August, we know when the grasses are out there, they can be out grazing, and it doesn't affect them as much as a Holstein. Also, with a Jersey, they don't produce as much milk as a Holstein, your black and white traditional dairy cow, but their butter fat is much higher. So our cheese yield is more, and it's a creamier milk. So we chose Jerseys for two different reasons, but I did want to add a little funny on that is, yes, the cow did just pop up in my driveway. My first cow, because like I said, I grew up in town. My husband's been around cows all of his life, but you know, we were not dairying until we decided to do the cheese. So I took a couple cheese courses in a couple different places. I got hooked as a hobby and doing it in the house and on. I said, I want my own cow, because you talk about, you know, this business that we're going to get into. It sounds very involved. So I need a dairy cow here on the farm because I want to know what basic milk is like, and then just the whole process of it. So I didn't think he took me seriously, but he really did. So Christmas morning, Christmas morning, I guess about 13 years ago this Christmas, he woke me up at 5 a.m. and said, "Oh my gosh, you're late." And I'm like, "No, we're ready." And at this point, we had three kids, and I'm like, "You woke me up at 5:30." You know, he said, "No, your Christmas present's downstairs, and you're late. You got to get busy." And I'm like, "Wow, this is awesome." So I went out, and there was this big, beautiful Jersey cow with those big brown eyes and those long eyelashes, and looking at me like, "Okay, I'm ready. Time to milk." So I had no idea what I was doing. So I ran back in the house. I'm crying. I'm thinking, it's all excited and everything. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, my first cow is so cool. Come teach me." He says, "No, this is a connection you're going to make with that animal." I was mad, and he thought it was funny, you know. So there are pictures of me milking her by hand. So she became our family cow, and we practiced on her. So we drank her milk. We made cheese, yogurt, ice cream, and it's really the cheese that I fell in love with because there was more art, I think, in cheese than there was in the other products. And my husband thought it was a great idea because if we couldn't market the cheese, we started out with cheddars. Cheddars only get better with age. So if you can't move your product right away, maybe it would get better with age. So it's like, you know, so there's all the factors in that one.
I want to get back to choosing the animals that you're actually going to be milking. There are quite a few different dairy breeds of goat. There's the compact, actually my favorite, which is called a La Mancha goat. And everyone always asks us why we cut the ears off, but we don't. They're very short ears, and they're the only American bred goat. So they're the most friendly of all the goats, very compact, and they have very high butter fat. So we have a lot of those at the dairy, but they don't produce as much milk as the larger dairy goat breeds. So we have the La Manchas and the Nubians, which are the ones with the very long ears. We have those for the butter fat. And then we have the Saanen goats, which are the size of a small pony and all white. And then we also have the Alpine, the French Alpines, for the milk, the numbers to get that quantity up. And I'm not sure how it works with sheep or cows, but we have some goats that we do a three-year milk through with, so we don't rebreed. So we can do that, and that's how we do choose a lot of the animals that we end up using in the milk line. Is we kind of have gone through their progeny and picked and chosen types of goats that we want to keep in the milk line. So and we. I guess with all your cows, we bottle feed all of our goats, so they're very friendly. And goats are very curious animals. Most of them can unlock the gates. They can, they're very, very clever, but they're just really intuitive, and they're my favorite animal out there because they're just they're great as pets. They're great with their milk, but we milk them. All year round, and I guess with the sheep, you don't milk them all year round. But with goats, we do, and they do have the same type milk cycle as the sheep. This time of year, the milk is becoming with more butter fat, and you're getting higher yields. So with us, it varies by about 7 or 8 pounds when we make our type of cheeses with the time of year. So
right. Now with the sheep is, and the reason why we pick this is we're 6 months on. 6 months off, so they milk for 5.5 months or so, and then they dry themselves up. These dairy sheep are really cool because come the summer solstice, their brain will automatically start to ratchet themselves down and drive themselves up. So you can birth out January 1st, or you can birth out July 1st. It doesn't matter. By the end of October, they've dried themselves up automatically. And so that's what we thought would be really neat, because as we got older, we knew we were going to get tireder. And we were going to have the break, you know? But there's no break.
I'm wondering where all the different cultures come from. You talk about all the different cultures of the world. Where do you get them, and what are they? What makes them different?
From us, we just order them from a wholesaler, but I remember when we were up at the Vermont College taking some cheese courses up there. There was a gentleman that came in one day, and he talked all day long about nothing but bacteria and cultures. And I kept staring at this guy going, "So you went to college to sell cultures, you know?" And that is his whole entire job. Now, we just buy ours from a regular wholesaler. I don't know where everybody else.
Yeah, we just buy it from a wholesaler out west. But most of them originate in France, and then
right?
they bring them over, and then they can buy them in bulk, and then they just kind of repackage to, you know, people for like us that are smaller for that.
There's a wholesaler in Wisconsin called Dairy Connection, and that's where we get our cultures. Most of them are from France, but the wholesaler. They're a great resource. You call them and say, "And I'm having a little problem with this or that, or is this," and they could be on the phone with you for an hour or 2 hours, and they help you to work through the problem. So it's a very complex, and you can get a type of bacteria from here or there, and something doesn't turn out, and they usually, 9 times out of 10, can help me nail it down within a few minutes.
So how do you know what kind of culture you want?
Well, it all depends on
culture catalog.
You shoot for the style of cheese you want. So one of the best words of advice that was ever given us is you work backwards. Like Holly said, you figure out what your customer wants and you work backwards, and that goes all the way back up to milking the animal itself. It's a backwards business. So if tomorrow, if you wanted a blue cheese with a orange rind on it, and you said, "Can you do that for us?" we would pick up the phone and go, "We have this customer that owns this restaurant, like Spike. I want a blue cheese with an orange rind, and how about working on that?" And if they don't know the answer, we'll get back to you next week, because they'll start making phone calls. You know.
So, based on the fact that this is about origins, can you give a little bit, maybe, is it Andina?
Anandina.
Can you explain the history of American cheese? Because we are talking about recent stuff, but was there a history of cheese that happened before the fast food market and then picked up again? And then where are you guys getting your information for making cheese now? Obviously, the cheese magazine that Anne loves. And what other resources do you use for learning?
So, I think that when the Industrial Revolution happened, that a lot of cheese just became mass-produced, and that's whenever we get our, 40 to 100-pound blocks of cheddar that are vacuum-packed and just shipped out in, pallets and pallets of them. And then in the 70s, a lot of it happened in California and Vermont. Some of it started with people who would breed animals for show, like a goat breeder. Cypress Grove Creamery in California is a really good example. They were breeding goats, and then they had too much milk. And so they made cheese, and they made really good cheese. So they were definitely one of the beginners in that. And then also Vermont Creamery, they make some really beautiful little goat's milk cheeses, and that's another really great example. So then through the 70s and the 80s, and really in the mid-90s is whenever it started to get it's the force behind it. But I really think that 2000 and on is whenever the American Cheese Society conference this year, I think they had 260-some entries and 1,700 different cheeses entered in 2015.
So. Wow. And Martha was stating there's a really, really great cheese magazine, if any of your cheese nerds out there would want to try to find it. It's usually at Wegmans and other local places. It's called Culture Magazine, and it's really a great cheese magazine.
So my understanding with winemakers is they always have a reserve kind of wine that doesn't get distributed as frequently. So do you all have that special kind of cheese that even Spike doesn't have access to?
Wait a minute. You can't say that.
And Spike's promised me he'll sign a disclaimer that says that I hear this. But and if you do, what is it? What are you trying to achieve with your special cheese, probably brought out at holiday time or birthdays or whatever occasion?
Are you specifically asking the one that won the competition, or
I'm asking for the one that you have down in your cellar that you
well.
And here's the story. I've seen shows in Burgundy where, the wine's there for, eons, because it's a family endeavor. You all are family farmers, I can tell by that. Do you have the same thing going on with your cheese?
We tried to do that with our Talbot Reserve 1-year cheddar. That was one of the first cheeses that we did, and it did only get better with age. And so we accidentally, on purpose, just left a box or two laying around for another year. Brought it out, and it blew my socks off. So we literally just gave that as Christmas presents to all of our customers, and said, this is what we could do if you all would stop buying Talbot Reserve so we could, like, age it another year. But nobody paid attention to that.
Can you tell them what the margins were?
I just, you know, and then when you think about a year's worth of cheese aging another whole year, the storage, you know, that is for that is insane when we get into, you know, volume of it. So yes and no, and then we play with different things, you know, like we have a couple things in our back pocket that we're working on right now that will, like I said, we're rotating a couple of our cheeses, and I'm excited about that. But I mean, I think with like any business, if you're not constantly changing and evolving and upgrading and doing things, if you're kind of staying at that same, then I think you'll be in trouble. So we're always looking at different things. And going to the American Cheese Society conference, you know, every once in a while or even every year, their classes are amazing. They teach us a lot that cheese making and cheese makers are a really neat group of networking people, and we all are very supportive. So the people that buy it are the same way. So it's all about, we educate each other on it. So cheesemakers will give other cheesemakers ideas, and so there's still stuff stuck in the basement somewhere, and we'll see what it does.
With mine, it's not cheese. It's actually the goat cheese cheesecake. I make different flavors that haven't quite reached the mainstream yet, but lots of different flavors, and friends will say, hey, have you ever tried to make this? And then I'll make a couple cheesecakes and give them out, and so we'll see what comes up next.
Question back here.
So here's the question that I don't like to ask, because it's sort of the question that kills a lot of passionate ideas early off. But what were sort of the avenues that you all pursued for funding these operations when you were starting them up?
We did everything. We sold a house that was totally sold. I mean, that totally paid off. We took in these huge amount of debt. Applied for grants. Got turned down for a lot of them. They thought we were crazy. Family and friends walked away from us, thought we had lost it. And now all of a sudden they're hanging around. which I think is like, So there was, it's a hard way to describe it. It's passion. Strictly passion.
Okay, so he's done this before. Okay, because we really...
You don't know.
I mean, here we are, 50 years old, were 5 years ago. Okay. Okay, 50 years old, and we had a paid-off house, we said. And we, you know, I had a job I'd been at for 21 years. It was an okay job, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. Never was what I wanted to do. Wasn't completely sure what I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to be doing that. So we had had a lot of experience in agriculture, a lot of good friends. We had a great friends. House, great neighborhood. And we started telling people, we think we'd like to try to do this, you know, because we had had sheep. We already knew the husbandry of taking care of sheep, but we didn't know the cheesemaking part, of course. So anyways, we decided, you know, to look into it, and we looked into it, and then we kept moving forward, and we started buying sheep, and we started making commitments, and we did. Okay. We are very simple people. We made very simple salaries, very normal, you know, run-of-the-mill salaries. Just made it from, you know, week to week. So to go into this, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, things like, you know, I'd really like to do this, or my son, he's coming out of college, you know, he'd like to get into something like this. Would you suggest this, you know, to be something for him to do?
The answer is no.
And I say to them, if you are not willing, and this was one comment that I'll include in this, If you're not willing to go feed your animals before you feed yourself, if you're not willing to go outside when it's 10 degrees out and it's pouring down rain and you're going to get totally soaked to the bone and stay out there for 2 hours so that you can take care of those animals, then don't even think about it. Because you have to have enough passion, guts, to be willing to do that and to risk everything that you have. So in doing this with these very low incomes that we had, I went looking for grants. I went looking for loans. We went to Farm Credit. Farm Credit was the first one who said, you know what? I've never heard of milking sheep. I'm not so sure about this idea. Right. But I see a lot of cow dairies out there, and they're going under.
Right.
And maybe we could, you know, mingle. I mean, he kept coming back to us and saying, you know, I've got this cow dairy over in the next county, and they really need some help. Do you think that maybe you could take their milk and make cheese from that, too? You know, so I kept getting that from him. But I said, no, we need to focus on what we're doing, you know, and where we're going first. And then we'll talk to you later. But they banked on us. Banks wouldn't, but they were willing to give us a loan. And then I was able to get loans. So I do my own taxes. So first year I did the tax, and I did my depreciation schedule. And I looked at how much we had really put into this operation. I said, if I had known that it was going to be the amount of money it was, I would have never even tried.
Right.
I would have said, there's no way that we can do this. Forget it.
Right.
But we kept moving forward and trying. And so all of these people we're talking about, there were a couple people that said, oh, that sounds like a really neat idea. Maybe less than five out of the 200 people in our life probably, who thought, oh, okay, fine, you're really going to do this? I don't know about this. And then after we built the building and people started coming and seeing the building and seeing what we were doing, they were like, oh, wow, you really did this? Came together. It's working. And then as time went on and I started making more cheese and I started selling the cheese and everybody was liking the cheese, I was like, thank you, God. You know, thank you, because if I can't make a good cheese, then we're out of luck here.
Right.
So thank goodness that the cheese I make is reasonable, good. You know, I don't say that I'm an expert, but, you know, I have a long ways to go still. But we have done what we needed to do, you know, the homework and the best that we could to make it work.
And I'll just throw one little quick thing in there because I know we're running out of time. But I get up and milk, go do a full-time gig at work, and then I come back and milk again. So do any of you want to pull that trigger? I literally fall asleep driving, pull over, sleep, go back to drive again, besides that passion. So
I agree. It's all about the passion. It's, you know, I have to say, farmers in general, and what I've learned just from watching my husband and his family and all, is passion drives what they do, because I'm telling you, they're not making very much money, but they love what they do. They love the lifestyle. So my father-in-law, his birthday was yesterday, right? Yeah. He is 86, and he works 6 days a week, and he is keeping my husband on his toes, but meaning, like, we did not inherit the farm. So just like you guys, we went out as a young couple and bought a farm, and but we knew we had to do everything on a budget. So I learned how to put in fencing. You know, that was not on my life agenda, but now I've learned how to put fencing up. I appreciate things so much more, you know, pouring concrete, building buildings. I mean, you name it, we had to do it ourselves because there's a budget. And there, it was perfect what you said. If we knew the amount of money from the get-go that it would take to get this going and the amount of hours that you would have in it, that's why there's not a whole lot of people in it. It's the passion and the finances and then the hours that go into it. Rainey, that I had mentioned, our my very first cow, dairy cow that actually was milking on the farm, you know, she's 14. So she's, you know, she's like a pet. She has her own personality. There's a pecking order in the herd. We are attached to these animals, and when they need us, they need us, you know, and we have to be there for them. And we give ourselves it's a sense of accomplishment too, I think, and along with the pride that you've done a good job taking care of that animal, that you've given them the best life that they have. So that was one of the reasons why we're not certified organic, because if Rainey had an infection in her foot, say that we would treat homeopathically, which we do, if it went to another level that we needed to give her an antibiotic, I would have to get rid of her. And I'm like, oh no, we are not getting rid of Rainey, because every cow here is like born on our farm. They're named by our children. They're bottle fed as babies. They all have their personalities. They all have their quirks of what they're doing. It's like, and they are around for a long time because we take care of them. They're grass fed. They're not, we don't rotate animals like that. You know, like I said, she's 14 years old. So it's like, you know, it's a lot of factors that go into it. But I think like what you guys said was passion was the main thing.
So when we got our pasteurizer for the dairy, the gentleman from the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture actually went with us down to get the pasteurizer. So, you know, everybody's passionate about, you know, cheese making that's into it. I mean, it was on New Year's Day, and it actually happens to be the pasteurizer that was used at the Naval Academy. So pretty interesting there. But, you know, taking it and installing it and figuring out all the little quirks. And then as far as the passion with the goats, you know, we just love to take our goats to farmers markets, different, you know, restaurants, have our chefs up to the dairy or the farm, just so everybody can see what goes into it on a day-to-day basis, because it really is a lot. But everybody that does this, you either have to be all in or it just doesn't work. So.
Wow.
I think on that note, we should all go eat some of their cheeses, right? So thank you, Spice, thank you, Pam, and Adina, Kelly, Colleen, and Michael. And thank you all for coming.
I'll just say something about supper. Hopefully you got to taste the cheeses kind of in their pure and natural state before our talk. And now we've... you know, guess what we're having? It's going to be the cheesiest dinner we ever had. But, David and I put our heads together on this supper, and we came up with an old favorite of mine, something my mom used to serve us, which was Welsh rarebit, or rabbit, depending on how you... So we have several variations of that with the cheese sauce that includes cheese from all these great producers, a little bit of stout from Milk House, one of our great farmhouse breweries, some Worcestershire sauce, which is a critical part of this that we made from local ingredients, a little bit of Trickling Springs cream, and that's kind of the main thing. We've also got beautiful mac and cheese and some salads and accompany us to kind of lighten things up if that's possible. And I hope you enjoy supper. It's such a pleasure to talk to you guys and hear your stories. Unbelievable. I just want to go out there and buy more cheese and eat more cheese. We'll start tonight. Thanks again, you guys.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifacts for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York, for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.